When I think of mead, I think of that sweet golden color drink that is often associated with the Vikings. But that is by far not the only type of mead out there. Like in medieval France, people would risk third-degree burns to create a dark, almost black mead known as Boucher. So thank you to Factor for sponsoring this video as I make the black mead of 14th century France, this time on Tasting History. So I've made mead here on the channel before, way back in 2020, shortly after I began. But it was a 13th century mead that was rather simple. Delicious, but simple. But mead is often not simple. It can become very complex with different flavors added from herbs and spices and different flours. And then there is a mead called Boucher, and it gets its flavor and color from caramelizing or even burning honey. The recipe comes from Le Ménager de Paris, which was a guidebook written by an older gentleman in Paris in 1393 with the aim of teaching his young wife how to run a household. And there's one section of the book that is filled with different remedies for when somebody gets sick, and that's actually where this recipe is found, in Beverages for the Sick. So the recipe begins: to make 6 sextiers of Boucher, take 6 pints of very sweet honey and put it in a cauldron on the fire and boil it. And stir for so long that it starts to grow, and you see that it also boils and bubbles like small blisters which will burst, releasing a little bit of dark smoke. Then add 7 sextiers of water, and boil so much that it reduces to 6 sextiers, and keep stirring. And then put it in a vat to cool until it is lukewarm. Then strain it through a cloth and put it in a barrel, and add a pint of yeast from ale, because that is what makes it piquant. Though if you use bread yeast, it makes as good a flavor, but the color will be duller. And cover well and warmly so it ferments. So that is his basic recipe for what he calls Boucher, though there are numerous spellings of that word that you can find in other medieval manuscripts, but that's how he spells it. Though unfortunately, since he wrote this in 1393, he does use an archaic form of measurement known as a sextier, sometimes a septier, even though sex and sept mean two different things, they both are the same thing in this case. And that word also has lots and lots of other spellings throughout the centuries. And not only spellings, but different quantities. The amount that a sextier is varies wildly from century to century, and even from location to location. Luckily, the other unit of measurement, the pint, is a little more consistent throughout history. So we are able to kind of guess exactly what he's talking about, especially because we do know a bit more about what this quantity would have been in Paris at the time. It's not perfect, but the ratios should end up being about right, and since I'm cutting this way down anyway, the ratio is all that matters, because this recipe makes a vat of Boucher. I don't have a vat, so I'm making a much smaller amount. So for this recipe, I am using 1 pint of honey, 1 gallon plus 2 cups of distilled water, and 5 grams of dried ale yeast. You can also add a few grams of yeast nutrient if you want. It's not absolutely necessary, but it does kind of help speed up the process. Ideally, what you're actually using is ale barm, but unless you've been brewing some medieval ale, you're not going to have any of that. Unfortunately, I have not been brewing any medieval ale, though I do want to do that once I have a kitchen again. This is actually the last recipe that I made in my kitchen before they tore everything out. It's kind of being redone. So I haven't been cooking as of late, and I've really been relying on meals from today's sponsor, Factor. I often make HelloFresh meals in my kitchen, but without a kitchen, can't really do that because it does involve cooking. But Factor doesn't involve any cooking because Factor delivers chef-crafted, ready-to-eat meals to your door, and they only take a couple minutes to prepare. Yet because they're fresh and never frozen, the flavor is all there. They're really, really good meals. And while they're perfect if you have no kitchen, they're more perfect for if you just have no time. If, you know, you don't have time to prepare an entire meal, you can just heat up a Factor meal and not have to rely on takeout. And they have 35 weekly options with meals for everyone, whether you're vegetarian or vegan, keto, or just like delicious food. So head over to factor75.com or just click the link in the description and use my code TASTINGHISTORY50 to get 50% off of your first order plus 20% off of your next month of orders. That's TASTINGHISTORY50 at factor75.com for 50% off of your first order plus 20% off of your next month of orders. Now to start with our mead, we're going to begin with the honey. Actually, we're going to begin with the pot that you're going to heat the honey in. Use a pot that is so much bigger than you think that you need. Also, I recommend wearing gloves and long sleeves at the very least while you're making this, because the burning honey does sputter a lot, and when you get it on your skin, you're going to have a bad time. And before you add the honey to the pot, you're going to add a gallon of water to the pot and use either a ruler or at least a spoon to measure how high that water comes up, because that's the amount of liquid that we want at the very end of the process after everything reduces. So you can tell how much you need in there after everything reduces. So add the honey to a very large pot and then set it over medium heat and let it slowly warm up. After just a minute or two, it'll go from thick and viscous to a more liquidy consistency. Then after a couple more minutes, you'll start to see bubbles around the edge of the pot. And once that happens, you want to start slowly stirring. And you're gonna keep stirring pretty much the whole time for the next 15 minutes or so. So save your strength. Another minute in and the honey will start to create a foam across the top. And once the foam covers the top, that is when things can quickly get out of hand. So just keep an eye on the temperature and make sure that the honey doesn't foam up too much. But the honey will foam up some and you want to keep it bubbling. So to keep the foam down, just keep stirring and making sure to scrape the sides so nothing burns. At about 6 minutes in, you should start to see the honey begin to darken and large bubbles will start coming to the surface. Now, in many modern forms of bocher, this is actually where you stop. It's just starting to caramelize, and now you'll have a lovely, light, caramely flavored bocher. But the 14th century recipe is pretty specific in how far it wants us to take this, so we're gonna keep going ahead. Let it keep boiling, and eventually the honey will start to steam and even let off a little smoke. But if you keep stirring, it will not be burned, just toasty. As you approach 10 to 12 minutes, the foam on top becomes thick and large bubbles will swell and burst, letting off dark steam. This is what you're looking for. This is what the recipe calls for. It says that they're like blisters bursting, which is gross to use in a recipe, but that's what they call it. And this is also where the recipe gets really quite dangerous. So again, long sleeves, gloves, be careful and do not look over the pot. Please, you will lose an eye. Because you are about to add the water and the boiling honey will sputter and shoot up and hot steam will fill the whole area. When I did this, there ended up being honey kind of just all over the wall and everything near it. It was a little crazy, and luckily they came in the next day to redo the kitchen so I didn't even have to clean it. So continue to slowly add the water and the sputtering will eventually subside and the honey will actually harden, and that's okay. Just leave it on the heat for a few minutes, and as it heats back up, the honey will dissolve again. You want to bring the bocher up to a gentle boil and then start to let it reduce until it hits that gallon mark. That's why it's important to measure the gallon before you start this process. For me, it took about 40 or 45 minutes for it to reduce that much, but just keep an eye on it. Once it's reduced, take it off the heat and set it aside and let it cool down, preferably to just like slightly warm, but no more than 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Then pour it into a vessel for fermenting, and you want to strain it through a sieve, or you can get a funnel like mine that has a sieve built into it. And as it continues to cool, you can mix your yeast with just a few tablespoons of water to waken it up, and then add that to the bocher. And again, make sure it is no hotter than 120 degrees Fahrenheit to be safe, because you could kill the yeast, and then all of your work was for naught. Now, technically, this is the end of kind of what you need to do. You just let it ferment. But there is a second optional part in the 14th century recipe that I am going to do. And that says, if you want to make it very good, add 1 ounce of ginger, long pepper, grains of paradise, and cloves in equal amounts, except for the cloves, of which there should be the least. And put them in a cloth bag and toss it in. And when it has been 2 or 3 days and the bocher smells of spices and is strong enough, take out the bag and wring it out and put it in the next barrel that you make. And so this powder will serve you well up to 3 or 4 times. And this is not uncommon to add spices. Most old mead recipes, whether it's Boucher or any other kind of mead, do add spices. So for this, you want 5 grams of ginger, 5 grams of long pepper, 5 grams grains of paradise, and 2 grams of cloves. And you really want dried whole spices for this, nothing that is pre-ground. You want to give them just a slight grinding before we're going to use them. Also, if you don't have long pepper or grains of paradise, I suggest you get some. I'll put links in the description. They're wonderful. They were very popular in medieval Europe, and they're both types of pepper, but they're so much more complex than the black pepper that we have today. Long pepper came from India typically, and grains of paradise from Africa. You can still get them online or at some specialty shops, and they're just fun. So I'm going to crush these up just slightly, but not into a fine powder, just enough to break them open, and then mix them all together and set them in a piece of finely woven cloth like muslin and tie it into a sachet with a good length of string left for it to dangle. Now I'm adding one more ingredient which isn't technically mentioned in the recipe but would have been present, and that is wood chips. Now they wouldn't have had wood chips, they would have had wooden barrels. This was typically fermented in a wooden barrel, but I'm using a glass jar to ferment, so I'm not going to get any of that flavor from the wood. But many places today that specialize in brewing or making wine do have wood chips that you can add to add that flavor, so I'm using some wood chips. So add those and the sachet of spices to the mead and then put on a lid with a bubble airlock on top. Again, they would not have had this in medieval Europe. They would have instead either just left it open or put some straw or cloth over it to keep the buggies out, but it's not really the best way to do fermenting, not the safest way to do fermenting. So I do recommend the airlock, and then you just put a little water in there and it keeps everything out nice and safe, but it lets out the gases from the fermentation. You can't completely close this off or it will blow up. So you need the bubbler. Then you're going to set this in a dark place in the house and let it sit for 2 to 3 days, then take out the sachet of spices and let it ferment for another month or so. You'll know that it starts fermenting when the bubbles start coming up to the top and you can actually hear them, and you'll know that it's done fermenting when you can't hear the bubbles anymore. So mine took about a month, which is plenty of time to make sure that you are subscribed to Tasting History, and for me to tell you a little bit more about the history of medieval mead. So I was actually hesitant to do another video on mead because I kind of thought, well, I've covered it. I've trod this path. But 4 years after making that video, which really focused on mead in the Scandinavian and mythical world, I realize there is a lot more to talk about. So let us start with medieval Poland. Poland has a long history of beekeeping, so it's only natural that they also have a long history of mead making. All the way back in 996, a diplomat and traveler from Cordoba, Ibrahim ibn Yakub, visited the court of Poland's first historic ruler, Mieszko I, and he said that besides food, meat, and land for plowing, the country of Mieszko I abounds in mead, which is what the Slavic wines and intoxicating drinks are called. For centuries, mead was a centerpiece of Polish exports. The Poles and the Rus made exquisite mead that was prized above all others in the region. In his 1584 poem Roxalania, the Polish poet Sebastian Klonowicz praises the wines of Italy, but says that they can't hold a candle to the sweet and heavenly nectar that is mead. Earth proffers wine from the rich moisture of the dirt. Jove himself in heaven distills our mead. Bacchus is the author of the vineyard, Jupiter of honey. For if wine is born of the earth, then mead is born of heaven. None can deny it to be a dew celestial. There were several types of mead that were made in the region, and the most expensive, the most prized, was a mead made without adding any water at all. The only thing was honey, and then sometimes they would add the juice of cherries or different berries. And then they would seal it up, bury it, and let it ferment naturally for anywhere from 10 to 50 years. This type of mead was so precious that by the 15th century, Duke Janusz III of Mazovia restricted its consumption to the upper classes. Though because this mead was so expensive, it was usually only the upper classes who could even afford it. So restricting it to them kind of seems unnecessary. They were the only ones who could buy it. And mead in Eastern Europe at this time really does seem to be mostly associated with royalty specifically. Perhaps my favorite mead-loving royal was the 10th century Princess Olga of Kiev, later to become Saint Olga. Though her mead drinking takes place during one of her less saintly moments. See, her husband, Prince Igor, had just been murdered by the Drevlians, and she was upset. Olga was mad, and that makes sense. So she sends a note to the Drevlians saying that they must prepare great quantities of mead in the city where you killed my husband, that I may weep over his grave and hold a funeral feast for him. It seems sweet, but let me tell ya, do not mess with Olga, because she shared this mead with the Drevlians, and when they got sufficiently drunk, she had them all massacred. And this was only following her burning a bunch of them alive in a bathhouse while she stood outside taunting them. They don't make saints like that anymore. Now, she wanted this mead so that she could drink it as she mourned the loss of her husband, Prince Igor. And that does seem fairly common in this period in Eastern Europe. In fact, in the 9th century, a traveler, Ibn Rushd, visited the land that is now Serbia, and he wrote that they too drank mead on the occasion of someone's death, and when a year has passed since the death, they take 20 jugs of mead, or more or less, and go with it to that hill. The family of the deceased gathers, they eat and drink there, and then they go their separate ways. But mead wasn't only drunk during times of sorrow, but also times of celebration for festivals and weddings and all sorts of happy events. And when you move further west, it was the same case, but sometimes they used it as a form of payment, like in Wales. In the Welsh law code, known as the Laws of Hywelda, codified in the 10th century, it specifies that some people are to be paid in silver, while for others, a mess of food and a hornful of mead he receives from the court for his provision. There are also guidelines for how much of several different drinks a steward is to receive after giving food and drink to the king. A steward has the length of his middle finger of the clear ale from off the lees, and the length of the middle joint of the braggad, and the length of the extreme joint of the mead. Braggad or braggot was basically a combination of mead and ale, and while delicious, I'm sure, was not worth the same as just the mead. 2 vats of braggad, or 4 of ale, are paid for 1 of mead. The worth of a vat of mead which is paid to the king is 6 score pence. 9 handbreadths is the measure of the vat of mead when measured diagonally, that is, from the furthest bottom groove to the hither rim. Kings around this period were enamored with mead because while in Wales they were using it as a form of payment, in England, if the king was to come over, you had to make sure to have an ample supply of mead on hand. In the life of St. Dunstan, by a cleric simply known as Bee, he tells the story of King Æthelstan of England, who is coming to stay with a relative, Æthelfleda, at the monastery at Glastonbury. He sends messengers ahead to make sure that she is well supplied for when the king arrives, because it's not just the king. You have to remember, when the king came to visit, it was an honor, but it was an onerous one, because he usually traveled with hundreds or even thousands of people, and it was up to you to entertain and feed and supply them all. So it turns out that she had plenty of everything except for mead, and the messengers were like, well, this is not gonna fly. So she starts freaking out, and she goes to pray to Mother Mary for intercession, for some help, and it turns out, once the king gets there, at the feast, they start pouring the mead, and as the mead drains, the pitchers refill themselves, so there was never any less than a hand's breadth of mead in the pitchers. Now, this royal love of mead does apply to this era, but also much later. It continues on through the medieval age, even into the Tudor age, because Queen Elizabeth I had a favorite mead. Her beekeeper, Charles Butler, wrote a treatise in 1609, several years after her death, called The Feminine Monarchy, or The Treatise Concerning Bees and the Due Ordering of Bees. And he says, "One excellent receipt I will here recite, and it is of that which our renowned Queen Elizabeth, of happy memory, did so well like, that she would every year have a vessel of it." The recipe was 1 part honey to 6 parts water and was flavored with sweet briar leaves, thyme, rosemary, and bay leaves before being fermented. Then cloves and mace were added, and it was aged for 6 months. Sadly, it was not long after this period that the popularity of mead began to wane. By the 18th century, in Poland and Russia, vodka, which was much cheaper and much easier to make and much stronger, had really usurped mead's place. And in England, there were several reasons that it kind of went out of fashion. One was the dissolution of the monasteries by Queen Elizabeth's father, Henry VIII, because most of the beekeeping, and hence mead making, in England was done by monks. So with no monks, you had less honey and you had less mead. Another factor was the addition of adding hops to ale. This allowed the drink to have a longer shelf life while still being rather cheap, which made it more attractive to the average drinker. Now, mead didn't disappear entirely, it just became more of a niche drink. It was very popular amongst like countryside peasants who were making it for themselves because it was available. And to them, it was cheaper than wine, which had really become the more prestigious drink to have. Though some people also drank it for its medicinal properties. It was often thought to be curative, especially when infused with different herbs and spices, just as the bochet is. And in fact, there is a 16th century French treatise that talks about the curative properties of bochet, provided it is made properly. When the bochet is underdone and the honey is not well cooked, it bites the belly hard and generates the diarrhea and makes great suffering. But when it is well cooked and scented, it is delectable to the taste, and it smoothens the voice and clears the throat and the pipes of the lungs and comforts the heart and gives it jubilation. They started adding all sorts of different herbs and spices to the bochet and would sweeten it with sugar or raisins. Then they also sometimes would include less desirable ingredients, like shavings of ivory and hartshorn, each of 3 drams. And that's why I didn't make the 17th century recipe, but stuck with the medieval French recipe from the 14th century, which should be ready to drink. So after the mead has fully fermented, about a month, or when you stop hearing that bubbling, then you can go ahead and rack it. And basically, that is just pouring it into another sterile container and keeping out the dead yeast. Then you can either let it age for a while, or you can drink it as is, which is what I'm going to do right now. And here we are, bochet, the black mead of medieval France. It smells caramely. There is like a hint of burn, but not unpleasant. I'm not getting a lot of the spices from the scent, so I'm curious what it tastes like. That's really good. So it's not sweet at all. It's like mead can be really sweet. This isn't sweet at all. The spices are just enough. It's also not as viscous as many meads, and that's because it has a lot more water than most meads that you have today. Some meads today can have like 1 part mead to 4 parts water, sometimes 3 parts water. This is 6 parts water, 1 part mead. So definitely not as thick, probably not as alcoholic, but that's not the point. It's supposed to be curative. And I don't know about that, but tastes good. So I am going to let this sit and age, and maybe in a few months I'll give another crack at it, give another taste, and see how it develops. It's actually a lot more complex than most meads that I've had, and it's really good. I was worried that it was going to kind of be bitter because the honey had there was that burnt honeyness to it, but it's mellow, it's softened, it's delicious, and yeah, it's great. So next week, fingers crossed, I'll be back in my kitchen. It'll be a new kitchen, but it'll be my kitchen. So I will see you over there next time on Tasting History.